On an exceptionally hot evening early in July, a young man came out of the garret in which he lodged in S Place and walked slowly, as though in hesitation, toward K Bridge. He had successfully avoided meeting his landlady on the staircase. His garret was under the roof of a high five-storied house and was more like a cupboard than a room. The landlady, who provided him with garret, dinners, and attendance, lived on the floor below, and every time he went out he was obliged to pass her kitchen, the door of which invariably stood open. And each time he passed, the young man had a sick, frightened feeling, which made him scowl and feel ashamed. He was hopelessly in debt to his landlady, and was afraid of meeting her. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, Director of Distance Learning at Wyoming Catholic College, and you're listening to the After Dinner Scholar. The quotation I just read is the first two paragraphs of Fyodor Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. He, in this case, is Rodion Romanovich Raskolnikov, a college dropout, living in abject poverty in 19th century St. Petersburg, Russia. Consumed with misery, anger, and a strange sense of self-importance, Raskolnikov will, in the course of the novel, commit a double murder, plunging him into even deeper despair. Along the way, he'll meet Sonia Marmeladov, the child of a hopeless drunk, who, in order to support her father's second wife, who has tuberculosis, and their children, sells the only thing she possesses, herself, in prostitution. How the friendship between the harlot and the murderer becomes the source of redemption is the topic of the novel and was the topic of Dr. Virginia Arbery's address at the 2019 Wyoming School of Catholic Thought. This is what she had to say.
Well, good morning. I want to put the friendship we're about to look at in context with some other unlikely friendships, keeping in mind Aristotle saying that friendship between equals is optimal, but that friendship between unequals, that between somebody older and somebody younger, or between somebody superior in station in life or in wealth and another, can be equalized by the subordinate's greater virtue. So let me begin by highlighting three examples of friendship, though I'll develop only the first. And the first, of course, is that between our main character, Raskolnikov, a university dropout, and a teenaged prostitute. This friendship eventually will witness to what the English Jesuit Martin Darcy describes as agape, a love that draws friends together as Christ does to his feast in Eucharist, unlikely as that might seem, in a prison camp in Siberia. This is beyond, as we've suggested. There's some things beyond Aristotle's conception of a shared good pursued in friendship. We've already looked at some other examples of unexpected friendships, such as the near-suicidal teacher who, feeling a damp, drizzly November in his soul, flees from the classroom where he tires of his soul-enervating task of teaching ungrateful boys. Exhausted from trying to make the tallest boys stand in awe of him, as he puts it. He escapes to the whaleboats, you'll remember, of Nantucket, where he meets a very tall savage with tattoos from head to toe, who will become, as we've read, a bosom friend. Nothing in common, though, to the imaginative young teacher, Ishmael Queequeg is as adventurous as Peter the Great, as noble as George Washington cannibalistically realized. Queequeg is from Coco Voco, an island, as Melville wrote, not down in any map, adding, true places never are. This friendship develops through Ishmael's admiration for nobility and honor in Queequeg, two qualities he finds absent in his Knickerbocker friends from New York. in Moby Dick, the friendship between unequals demonstrates that the other, as you pointed out in our group, Father Thomas, perceived as inferior, even as barbaric, can be one's better. In the whole action of the novel, Queequeg's coffin, decorated with the whole meaning of the cosmos, he's decorated it, prepared for his own death, turns out to be the buoy that pops up out of the boiling seas vortex to save Ishmael after the entire ship and all its crew have plunged to their death following Moby Dick's attack on the Pequot. And our students love this novel so much that they've named their little bar, their little special space that we've given the older students, the Pequot. We wanted to put a little whale, you know, as a sign sticking out from the door, but we didn't think people coming to Lander, Wyoming would understand a whale. The third is the friendship between another school dropout, this one from grammar school, that I'm going to give us an example of. The son of a feral, drunken father, Huckleberry Finn, and a runaway slave, Jim. Despite how unequal they are in age, status, and color, the friendship between these two grows from one that is clearly instrumental, though pleasant to each of them, to one that is good for its own sake. Rather than returning the fugitive to his legal owner, Miss Watson, Huck, in gratitude for all the kindnesses done to him by Jim as they face life and death adventures down the Mississippi, decides to tear up the letter he has written to Miss Watson, confessing that he has harbored a fugitive from the law. In doing so, he overcomes what he understands to be his conscience, a nagging thing inside him, urging him to do the conventionally correct, the legal thing. Instead, listening to the deeper voice inside of him, he declares, tearing up the letter, prompted by his gratitude and friendship, he declares, "All right then, I'll go to hell." Mark Twain's American classic shocks its readers into the realization that, as Aristotle teaches, friendship is higher than justice. Why are we moved to think about friendships among unlikely pairs? Pairs portrayed for us in the great canon of biblical and other literature. David and Jonathan, Achilles, Patroclus, St. Gregory and Basil to some extent. Abelard and Heloise, one of my favorites. My middle name is Eloise. And if you know the story, that's not the best middle name to have. Our Lord and Mary Magdalene, St. Paul and the runaway slave Onesimus. We like these unequal or unlikely friendships because maybe friending someone in our current social media has lightened the meaning of friendship to a shell of its former meaning. Adding this depreciation of the weighty word friendship is an agenda-driven science which has reduced human beings to a chance development in the universe's big history. One untethered to a knowing, loving, designing God who has said, "I will call you not slaves, but friends," as our reading from yesterday. With such a schema, friendship with God is irrelevant. Once unmoored from the salvation history that is the pillar of Western civilization, civic unity itself is at risk. Indeed, civic unity seems to be a dream of the past. Now, I love George Washington, and every speech I give, I manage to work him in. One night, I think I was teaching for about 20 years then, and we still had all 8 children at home. And apparently, in my sleep, I turned to my husband and said, "George." But he wrote in his farewell address, you'll recall, that religion and morality are the great pillars of human happiness, the finest props of the duties of men and citizens, unquote. He goes on to warn that, quote, "reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle." Unquote. The two, he insists, virtue and morality, are the necessary spring of popular government. To my mind, to someone who went to school in the energetic, that's a nice way of putting it, time of the 60s, the tension between those who believed in Washington's admonition and those who did not has increased in intensity almost to the breaking point. Since 2016, I have this experience in my own family, no Trumpers won't speak to Trumpers or sort of Trumpers. Baby boomers annoy millennials. Gen Xers, Gen Zers, and those to be determined don't speak with anybody. Instead of loving and revering them, men fear women. And between heterosexuals and homosexuals and the 60-something other genders now claimed, there are strange exclusions or forced inclusions. Lately, some of our fellow citizens and governors claim that killing a baby, even up until birth, is a woman's right. While the Democrats in the Senate, especially the women all dressed in white, express no outrage. Together, both groups cannot grasp that a baby is a person. Julia, you've seen Julia, she'll grow old in a world where there is hardly a Down syndrome person, since as of now, over 90% of all of them with one extra chromosome are aborted. Amazing how fatal it is to have an extra chromosome, which to my mind is a gift beyond expression. However, unlikely as reconciliation is between those who radically oppose notions, radically opposed notions of what it means to be human, I do believe there is hope for reforging bonds of community. To open the prospect of this new unity, we have to turn. I know that theology and philosophy is important, but I think it's actually more helpful in a divisive world such as our own, where reason isn't exactly governing most people's choices, that we turn rather to the poetic imagination, trusting that Dostoevsky's great work, Crime and Punishment, will warn us how modern ideology spawns horrific crimes. The novel will shed light on the path for us, as Virgil's epic poem did for the one pagan found in Dante's Purgatorio. The heaven-bound former pagan Statius tells Virgil, whose Aeneid he calls his mother and his nurse, tells Virgil, "You are like one who goes by night and carries the light behind him and profits not himself, but makes those wise who follow him." The action of Dostoevsky's novel imitates a soul's journey through sin and unrepentance, shows how a person might turn to a path of repentance, forgiveness, suffering, and love. Regarded as beautiful, tall, and handsome, like Dunya, but remarkably ungroomed, Rodion Raskolnikov is a 23-year-old dropout from college, hard-pressed for money. He lives in a slummy section of St. Petersburg. I think it's worse than Sasima. A city as hazy, foul-smelling, and full of cacophonous sounds in the heat of July when the novel is set, as is the state of his soul. His quarters are likened to a closet, a cupboard, or a coffin, as his horrified mother calls it when visiting, after a 3-year separation with Dunya, whom you've met. With hardly room to turn around, his worn couch is his bed, and his students often do, he spends a great deal of time sleeping. We've put many a child through college, and many a time it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon when I asked them to come down for a late lunch after having missed breakfast and slept the morning away. But their sleep, however, was usually due to sleep deprivation after a semester of long hours of studying. His is a sleep of avoidance. When asked by his landlady's maid what he does for work, he answers, "I think." The narrator of the novel writes that Nastasha, the maid who continues to bring him tea, though he hasn't paid for his boarding, simply dissolves in laughter. The young man's thought is monomaniacal, a little bit like Ahab in Moby Dick. The ex-student, ex-teacher struggles with bringing himself to act on the one idea germinating within him since writing his essay on crime. In this essay, he has outlined that there are two kinds of people, the extraordinary, the masters, and the rest, the masses. He aspires to the power of an innovator who can change the established order with violent acts for which he'll be later exonerated. Why? Because he'll bring about a new and greater order, impossible to attain without his violence. Such are the world-changing men of history, and he looks to Napoleon as his standard. Now, mid-19th century Russia, as you probably can surmise, was like our own, rife with the various nihilist and socialist schemes. Some sought to tear asunder Mother Russia's traditional attachment to orthodoxy, to the soil, to the Theotokos, the mother of God, replacing them with notions of communal living, women's liberation from children and marriage, redistribution of property, free love, radical feminism, and atheism. All of this is in the novel. Others, less revolutionary, erred on the side of the utilitarian views of Jeremy Bentham and the Enlightenment thought of Voltaire, Rousseau, and others. For Bentham, what is useful for oneself is good for everyone else. And for Rousseau, a generalized pity for others, abstractly regarded, becomes the new religion. For both Bentham and Rousseau, feelings and utility govern friendships rather than shared effort to understand and act upon the good. In all of these isms and ideologies, charity is severed from the source of love itself and from the happiness found pursuing it. In the mind of the young ex-student, happiness is power. Nevertheless, in his random acts of kindness, vestiges of his father and mother's fidelity to Russian Orthodoxy routinely surface. A divided soul, his motives are mixed. He thinks of himself as a secular humanist, the religion of no convictions except an altruism for this abstract category of humanity. This religion, however, leaves one vulnerable to the demonic. The two often go together. The theologian Romano Guardini pointed out after World War II that power awaits direction. That is a conscious will to move it toward an end. Wanting to give direction to the pity he feels for those who are abused, he is full of contempt and loathing for those who bleed others, desperate in their poverty, as he knows the widowed pawnbroker does. Raskolnikov thus feels justified in killing her. In the act, however, he also kills, unintentionally, her weak-minded sister, Lizaveta, who he was sure would be away during the time of his planned killing. Eventually, confessing his crime to Sonia, Raskolnikov explains that, quote, "I want everything that I see to be different than it is. I don't want to submit myself to anyone." Commenting on this claim, one critic observes that when a man sets himself in place of God and wants to reorder all of creation, murder is only the beginning of the revolt. Yet a meek-souled girl named Sofia, wisdom in Russia, embraces this murderer who tells her that in murdering the pawnbroker, he killed nothing more than a louse. He had murdered her friend too, Sonia's friend, the kind and much abused by both the pawnbroker and by men, Lizaveta. When Sonia learns of Lizaveta's murder, she holds her hand in front of her face with a completely childlike fright, as did Lizaveta when he cracked her skull with an axe in his second murder. The narrator describes Sonia's reaction to this dark revelation. All at once, as if pierced, she gave a start, cried out, and not knowing why, threw herself on her knees before him. What have you done to yourself? She jumps to her knees, threw herself on his neck, embraced him, pressed him very, very tightly in her arms, and continues to comfort him. Just why would the friend of the murdered victim embrace with tears the axe murderer? Why would she express concern for his soul before expressing grief and anger over her dear friend's senseless murder? When we look into the wide heart of this tiny, frail girl with thin arms, soft hair, and brilliant blue eyes to understand her embrace of Raskolnikov, we see that she is the moral and religious center of the novel. Sonia had been pushed into prostitution by her consumptive stepmother, who with her three small children would starve without Sonia's help. And unprotected from such a fate by her hopelessly drunk father, this young woman is hardly more than a girl. Raskolnikov, on one of his frequent aimless wanderings through the shadowy streets of St. Petersburg, had met her drunken father at a sub-street bar, where he learns of this only daughter's fate and the condition of the ailing wife and stepchildren. There, Marmeladov, deep in his cups, he's always deep in his cups, shares with this young stranger, Raskolnikov, a vision of forgiveness that he, even he, hopes for. The young man is silent during Marmeladov's vision of divine mercy. Now I'm going to read you a rather long passage, and you're supposed to pretend that I'm a dissolute 50-some-year-old man who is well into the day's excesses. He will pity us who pitied everyone and who understood all men and all women. He alone, and he is the judge. On that day, he will come and ask, where is the daughter who gave herself for a wicked and consumptive stepmother, for a stranger's little children? Where is the daughter who pitied her earthly father, a foul drunkard not shrinking from his beastliness? And he will say, come, I have already forgiven you once. I have forgiven you once, and now too your many sins are forgiven, for you have loved much. And he will forgive my Sonia. He will forgive her. I know he will. And he will judge and forgive all, the good and the wicked, the wise and the humble. And when he is finished with everyone, then he will say unto us too, you too come forth. He will say, come forth, my drunk ones, my weak ones, my shameless ones. And we will all come forth without being ashamed and stand there. And he will say, swine you are of the image and the beast and the seal, but come, you too. And the wise and the reasonable will say unto him, Lord, why do you receive such as these? And he will say, I receive them, my wise and reasonable ones, for as much as not one of them considered himself worthy of this thing. And he will stretch out his arms to us, and we will fall at his feet and weep and understand everything. Then we will understand everything, and everyone will understand, Lord, thy kingdom come. Though the young man seems unmoved by such a vision, nevertheless he listens, and he goes to the drunk's shabby apartment. From an instinctual generosity that he exhibits on multiple occasions throughout the novel, He discreetly leaves the impoverished family all of the 30 rubles that his mother and sister have just sent to him. This is the family situation, then, for the used girl to whom he will go after his dual murders. But why? Why to her? Raskolnikov goes to Sonia twice because he sees that, despite her harlotry, she holds to a center. The first time that he had gone to Sonia, after the murder, but before his admission to her, the lost Raskolnikov had asked the girl to read him the story of Lazarus from the Bible. Observing his disordered state of soul that shone in his fiery eyes, she's frightened and puzzled by the request from her family's benefactor. As she reads from St. John's Gospel, we too hear of Jesus' intimate friends, Martha and Mary, both chiding him for not being with them when their brother was dying. Gradually, the frightened girl's voice grows in strength, her passion for hope increasing, and she reads, "The Lord saying to Martha, said I not unto thee that if thou wouldst believe, thou shouldst see the glory of God? Then they took away the stone. He cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he that was dead came forth." The narrator observes that, quote, "the candle had long been burning out in the bent candlestick, casting a dim light in this destitute room upon the murderer and the harlot, strangely coming together over the reading of the eternal book." Raskolnikov listens as if disinterestedly to what he cannot as yet know will be his own rebirth from the death of his soul. He's not ready to understand, but in that dim light, a seed is planted counter to the evil one with which he is obsessed. Later, he will come to know his own resurrection. In the moment, in his twisted, godless mind, he identifies his stepping over the line of God's law in his murders as being the same as the transgression as Sonia's forced prostitution. In the murders of which she still is ignorant, his pride compelled him to commit an act that would prove that he, like Napoleon, is above the populace, the ordinary, the deplorables, that he is born to be a master. He conflates his submission to pride, which led to those murders, with Sonia's submission to prostitution, which he charges has destroyed her life, though her path is, paradoxically, out of love. He goes to her, another cursed one, as he calls her, telling her that she is the one he needs above all in the world. So despite his mockery of her faith, she prays with her entire being that a miracle will change his heart. Her prayers, a sign, he thinks, of her insanity. Afterwards, Raskolnikov calls Sonia a sinner. "You have a ruined life, your own. It's the very same thing as mine." In saying so, he has fully entered the realm of the diabolical. He is guilty of what one has called a fiendish lie, that is, to lay down one's life for one's friend, understood as being the very same thing as destroying the life of one's neighbor. In their first meeting, when she read to him the story of Lazarus, Raskolnikov promises the confused girl that he will tell her later of the one who killed Lizaveta, saying, "I've chosen you. I won't come asking forgiveness. I chose you long ago to tell it to." The disturbed murderer leaves, and she spends the night in delirium, dreaming of Raskolnikov, doing this, kissing her feet, weeping. Dostoevsky, it seems to me, in this and in other scenes, probes the human heart at precisely the point when dismay overcomes it. Dismay for those we love who have lost their way. So many of us feel deep pain when those whom we love go off in a dark direction. Dostoevsky also reveals the hidden disgust we feel for those who refuse to share the same assumptions we hold about the virtuous life. Keep in mind that Raskolnikov is a consequential young man, as some of our relatives, friends, or students are. All the good people in the novel, his mother, his sister, his wonderful university friend, Razumikin, you know that this is Raskolnikov's only friend, who sticks by him and his family. Even his prosecutor, Porfiry, try to save him when he is in fever, delirium, or wrestling with his dark side. Raskolnikov is the golden boy, worth everyone's attention. For that reason, he's also the kind of person that the evil one and the depraved wish to derail. They will do everything to make him submit to their own despair. So in the second meeting, in the final scene of this admission of guilt to which I've previously referred, Sonia's gesture of embracing the murderer of her friend is most Christ-like. Meeting, as Father Schumacher has taught us, not treating others as they deserve, but as they need. In the room in which she has received her customers, her embrace of Raskolnikov is not carnal, but salvific, even though, at the time, he refuses to acknowledge that he needs to be forgiven or to suffer for his sins. Growing stern, Sonia in this scene orders Raskolnikov, as Beatrice does Dante in his purgatorial ascent, to admit his fault, and to do so by throwing himself on the earth in public, kissing it in its four corners, and shouting out each time, "I have killed." Though he kisses the earth to the amusement of the riffraff of St. Petersburg's pedestrians, who say, "Ah, there goes another drunk, a bum, and so young, clearly a gentleman, what a shame." Right? He is loath to admit his guilt, even to admit the moral category of guilty. Despite his confession to Sonia, though, he's unrepentant, and his heart remains closed. He is ashamed, not of his sins, but of his failure to pull the murders off without confessing. His confession to his interrogator, Porfiry Petrovich, a Russian prototype of Columbo, of the American detective series. He's just one of my favorite figures of all in literature, this Petrovich. And he gets the sentence mitigated by a plea of temporary insanity to only 8 years of hard labor in Siberia. Once in Siberia, after months of isolation in his heart, his fellow prisoners turn on him one day in Lent, yelling that he is an atheist, a God-hater. They attack him. He's radically alone, separated from the earth, from nature, and from all other human beings. He's so indifferent to his conditions that he completely ignores the roaches in the soup, the wooden plank for a bed, the hard work, the cold. He's disembodied, not in himself, but acting mechanically, performing tasks, feeling no connection to himself, to other prisoners, or even to the faithful Sonia, who follows him to Siberia. There, she ministers to the other prisoners by writing letters to their families, baking Easter treats, being the go-between between their sweethearts and their wives. And all this time, she visits Raskolnikov, who bears a puzzling resentment to her goodness and to her faith. The novel speaks to our own day. We can all think of conversations ending in anger and in mutual accusations over fiendish lies held as convictions by those who do not share our belief in God or our hope in his mercy. Parents and children, friends and neighbors find themselves on opposite sides where conversations cannot continue without plenty of libation in order to dull the recognition that there is no connection, no matter how connected we think we are. Recently, an eminent law professor that I know happened to be at a conference with me during Holy Week. It was Easter Week. And he'd just been baptized before on Holy Saturday. And he was a 70-some-year-old Jewish man. right? And I'd known him for years as a famous Jewish lawyer. And he said, would you go to church with me? I said, huh? I said, sure, right? And then he told me his story. And then I said, well, you know, and your wife, you must come in together. He goes, no. You know, they've been married over 40 years. She's a Japanese lady. He said, no. He said, she cannot abide a religion that believes in mercy. I said, I was kidding. You know, I was shocked. I said to him, well, you must be an awfully good husband if you've never had to ask her for mercy. And he explained that in her view, a religion that allows unjust people into it is a religion full of weak people. And I said, oh, that precisely. Yeah, right. He explained that his wife was adamant that no one should do anything for which he must ask forgiveness afterwards. Uncomfortable, I didn't know what to say about that. I said, well, what about your son? You know, did he come into the church? And he said, no, but he's been an atheist his whole life. But now that he has children, he's interested in Judaism again. And you know, I was joyful for him, but I was just so exhausted by the world at that point, thinking how hard it is in this world, what courage it takes to make those choices. Well, to conclude, at the end of Dostoevsky's novel, to the utter surprise of Sonia, Raskolnikov does fall to his knees, as in her dream, and kiss her feet. In this reversal of a Magdalene washing Jesus' feet with her tears, she cannot believe that this miracle of grace could have happened to the man she has served, prayed, and followed to Siberia. The final version of the novel, some critics insist, is a tragedy and not paradisal. They can't believe that this transformation on Raskolnikov's part is earned in the novel. But let's look at it a little bit more. Raskolnikov has actually missed a few days that Sonia has not been able to visit him. He hears from the other prisoners who hate him, right, and who call her their little mother, right? He hears that she is ill. He finds himself missing her. And when she learns that he has missed her, she writes him a note assuring him that she merely has a cold. Later, on a clear, warm day, about 6 in the morning, the prisoner is baking gypsum in a kiln afterwards to be ground up. On the river's edge, across the steppe of the vast expanses of Siberia, Raskolnikov sees tents of nomads who are milling in and around their temporary quarters. Quote, there was freedom, he thinks. There, a different people lived, quite unlike those here. There, time itself seemed to stop, as if the centuries of Abraham and the flocks had not passed. Unquote. As one who has sought freedom from the strictures of society and the power to step over them, Raskolnikov is arrested. Stop. In his very soul, and hears a barely audible song come from the bank on the other side. Suddenly, Sonia appears smiling, amiably and joyfully. She timidly gives him her hand. She always gave him her hand timidly because he had always before taken it as if with loathing, always met her as if with vexation. Gives him her hand and trembles before him in deep grief. But at this moment, his face changes and their hands do not separate. He glanced at her quickly and fleetingly, said nothing, and lowered his eyes. No one is around. The guard is distracted. And the novel goes on. How it happened, he himself did not know. But suddenly, it was as if something lifted him and flung him down at her feet. He wept and embraced her knees. They wanted to speak, but could not. Tears stood in their eyes. They were both pale and thin, but in those pale, sick faces, there already shone the dawn of a renewed future, of a complete resurrection into a new life. They were resurrected by love. The heart of each held infinite sources of life for the heart of the other. And he goes on, they resolved to wait and endure. They still had 7 years more, and until then, so much unbearable suffering, but so much infinite happiness. For he was risen, and he knew it. Back in the barracks that night, lying in his plank, the transformed prisoner reflects on the, quote, torments of the past. The novel goes on. Everything, even his crime, even his sentence and exile, seemed to him now, in the first impulse, to be some strange external fact, as if it had not happened to him. For the first time, he stops thinking. He knows he cannot resolve anything in his mind. Dostoevsky writes, quote, he could only feel. Instead of dialectics, there was life, and something completely different had to work itself out in his consciousness. Unquote. Under his pillow lay the Gospels. He did not open the book yet, but he would in time. She had given him the Bible at his request, but she had never, though he expected her to do so, talked religion or morality. And the novelist ends with the comment that a, quote, gradual regeneration, unquote, was about to begin. A gradual transition from one world to another, his acquaintance with a new, hitherto completely unknown reality. It is this extraordinary, silent injunction of the novel to wait in hope, to be patient, to bear the deep grief of the separations and of friendships that we have known civically and familially, so that the good seed can have time to grow under Providence's care. It is this silent injunction that gives us a vista of hope, not only between the harlot and the murderer, but between all those broken friendships. He did not even know that a new life would not be given to him, the novel concludes. He did not even know that a new life would not be given to him for nothing, that it still had to be dearly bought, to be paid for with a great future deed, unquote. The novel ends by calling us to do the great future deed of healing Russia for Dostoevsky, to free it from her illusions. And for us, it seems to me, to heal America, freeing her from her delusions. Soul restoration, however, is prior to civic restoration, and it takes place one criminal at a time, one friendship at a time, or here, one student at a time. Thank you.
God works in mysterious ways his wonders to perform, says the old hymn. Dostoevsky certainly had a sense of that. And strange, unexpected friendships can and do bring us beyond ourselves, drawing us to new heights. While Crime and Punishment does not exactly qualify as beach reading, if you've never read the novel, why not give it a try and see for yourself the power of unexpected friendship in a dark place. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.